Did y'all go and see Hamilton?
Yes.
Did you like it?
Yes.
I have a confession. I know very little about Hamilton. It's kind of embarrassing. I kind of consider myself a historian and like an historian of American history. So you would think I know a little bit about Alexander Hamilton, especially since everybody knows about Hamilton, but I don't. I know like two things. One, the obvious. Alexander Hamilton was in a duel, right? Well, so, embarrassing story. I'm at a party for Emma the other week, like a month ago, and this second grader comes up to me and goes, "Who shot Alexander Hamilton?" You want to know who I said? James Madison. She was like, "Aaron Burr." Terrible. All right. So the other thing I know about Alexander Hamilton, it actually comes from what I've read about Thomas Jefferson. All right, so maybe I know a little bit about Thomas Jefferson. All right, Jefferson, all right, it was like Aaron Burr, I think. He didn't like Hamilton. All right, I think the feeling was a bit mutual. All right, Jefferson seems to have been the type of guy who dwells on these things. All right, if you walked into Monticello, this was his house, right, in Virginia. If you walked in there and you walk right through the front door, on each side of you were these massive pillars and these great big busts of two men. One of them was Jefferson, and the other one was Hamilton, and they were staring at each other. I got to think that, you know, Jefferson had in mind this whole idea that you keep your friends close and your enemies closer, all right? And so every time he walks out his door, he's like, "I'm coming for you. I'm coming for you." Something like that. I don't know. So that's Jefferson. Funny story about Thomas Jefferson. One day he goes out to visit his daughter Martha. She had just given birth to her 12th kid, her 12th. He walks into the room with all the other kids around and everything, and I imagine him holding the baby, and this is what he says. "Seriously, my dear, we shall have to send you back to the convent." I thought it was funny. And so, Jefferson, of course, is best known for the fact that he wrote the Declaration of Independence, right? He was also president, but we all know him for the Declaration of Independence. "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal," sorry, women, by the way, "all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, and among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." Right? Okay. That's Jefferson. Some of the knock against Jefferson is that he kind of just ripped all of that from John Locke. John Locke was this like English guy about the 1700s, so the 18th century. And Locke was what you would call like one of the early proponents of liberalism. But liberalism in the terms of what we'd call like democracy instead of what we'd call like those Democrats or something like this, right? Not that type of liberalism. But liberalism in general, freedom. So Locke put things this way. He said that we're all endowed with the rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of property. Property. All right, stuff. Jefferson decided he wanted to broaden that a little bit bigger. So he said happiness instead of property. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Today I'm suggesting that we got to go even bigger than that. Even bigger than happiness. What we really want, what we're really after, is not just the pursuit of happiness, it's the pursuit of joy. The pursuit of joy. So let's take a look at our next Abraham and Sarah passage for today. This one's a little bit different. It actually comes from the New Testament, from the book of Hebrews, chapter 11. The author of Hebrews, we don't really know who this author is, but the author of Hebrews is talking about faith and what it's like to have it. Talking about faith and what it's like to have faith. Faith, he says, is the assurance of things hoped for. All right? It's the conviction of things not seen. And then we're given this long history of people who have actually had faith like this. Here's what it says. Abraham obeyed when he was called to set out for a place that he was to receive as an inheritance. And he set out, not knowing where he was going. By faith, he stayed for a time in the land he had been promised, as in a foreign land, living in tents, as did Isaac and Jacob, who were heirs with him of the same promise. For he looked forward to the city that has foundations, whose architect and builder is God. The text then goes on to explain that all of these people of faith, it had talked about Abel, it had talked about Enoch, Noah, then Abraham and Sarah, they all died. They all died in faith. They all died without, the text says, without having received the promises. But from a distance, it says, from a distance they saw and they greeted them. Imagine that. Imagine what it would have been like to trust in a promise, a mere hope, and yet never actually see it fulfilled. The sheer vision, the sheer draw of that promise, it seemed, that hope is what keeps you going, all right? According to a legend, the body of James, Jesus' apostle, so the apostle James, is buried underneath this massive cathedral in northwestern Spain. All right, the Cathedral of Santiago de Compostela. Anybody been there? Me neither. All right. I've been to Madrid. I saw a bullfight. It was really bloody. All right. And so that's your seven-minute break there. Now we're back to the text. Okay. Because James is buried there, people have been taking pilgrimages there for like 1,000 years. 1,000 years of pilgrimages. All right. In his book on the Iberian Peninsula, James Michener. Michener is the guy who did Tales from the South Pacific. All right, Hammerstein, Bernstein and Hammerstein's movie South Pacific, or musical, is based off of this. Okay, so Michener explains how these medieval Christians, they would travel from France, Paris, all right? They'd take these super long pilgrimages all the way over to the western coast of Spain, about 1,000 miles, and as they were getting close to the city, as they were cresting over, they were started to see, they would just be able to catch a glimpse of the towers of the cathedral that were rising high above the rest of the city, and they'd shout, "My joy, my joy." They'd see it just on the horizon. They'd shout, "My joy, my joy." When I read this story, it reminded me of when we would take vacations. We'd leave from Dallas, and we'd always ended up going to the Rockies, most of the time Colorado. And sometimes we would go straight north of Dallas, all right? And we'd hit Kansas, and we'd take a left. And if you've ever been in western Kansas, it's nowhere. There's nothing in western Kansas. It just goes on and on. And you're like, who could eat this much corn? It's just corn forever. And as like a six-year-old, that's the worst. And so I'm there, and then finally I'm looking out the front window thinking, please God, where's the horizon? Please. And I see these little hazes, right, in the horizon. They look like clouds, but they don't move. And I realize they're actually mountains, and I think, oh my gosh, finally, mountains, mountains. And it takes another 6 hours to get there. And I'm thinking, why are we not there yet? It's that bad. All right? But I see them, I scream, my joy, my mountains. All right? This is what made me think of. All right? It's this idea. It's like these mountains were calling to me, and it gave me the hope to go on. All right? This is what the author of Hebrews is talking about. That's what he's talking about. As Abraham and Sarah traveled that long road of faith, even though they didn't live to see the end, they caught these glimpses of it. All right? They could see the promise just over the horizon, like the tips of the cathedral in northwest Spain, like the mountains as you're driving up to Colorado. They would greet these sights with shouts of joy, knowing there's the promise. There's salvation, there's peace, there's joy, right there. We've been talking a lot during Lent about the Christian life as a life of holiness, of righteousness, of making right what is wrong in our lives and in the world. We've talked about how God is the author of this holiness, how he's the pioneer and the perfecter of our faith, but that doesn't mean that we don't also have to walk it, right? We've talked about this. We've divested the things that we need to get rid of into those stones, and we brought them up, and we made a cairn of them, and we're giving them up, right? We're giving them up. We talked about how we don't want to take them back. We've done this. And so, but there's something we haven't talked about. It may be the most important question. Why? Why do this? Why be here? What's the point? All right, what's the point? Why invest in a life of holiness at all? Why take the time? Why? The answer is actually kind of simple. It's because it's better. It's better. Doing this holiness, righteousness thing, it's the only thing that leads to real joy. Real joy. Real joy. This is what the last of this story about Abraham and Sarah is telling us. Why do we pursue holiness? Because it's the path to joy. Listen to what comes next in the book of Hebrews chapter 11. Abraham and Sarah and these other people of faith, it tells us, they confessed that they were strangers, foreigners, on all the earth. Strangers and foreigners. For people who speak in this way make it clear that they are seeking a homeland. If they had been thinking of the land that they had left behind, they would have had opportunity to return, the text says. But as it is, they desire a better country, a heavenly one. So what is this better country? What's this heavenly one that's prepared for each and every one of us? Simply put, it's God. It's real, genuine peace with God and with each other. Chapter 12, the next chapter, the litany of people of faith is over, and the author says that since we are surrounded by this great cloud of people of faith, this great cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin that clings so closely to us. Let us run with perseverance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the pioneer, perfecter of our faith, who for the sake of the joy that was set before him endured the cross, disregarding its shame, and has taken his seat at the right hand of God. So why did Jesus live and die the way that he did? Because he saw the tips of that cathedral from a distance. Because he saw those hazy lines of mountains. All right? He carried his cross up that hill to die on it because he knew that the end of that road, there was true joy there. At the end of that road was God. God. There are two big things that I think we need to pay attention to in this passage. Two big things about what that road is and where it goes. We can talk about them, I think, as the path and the goal, or the way forward and the destination. So we've got the path and goal of this journey of holiness and the destination. So the path and way forward and the goal and destination. I think it's interesting that the text talks about seeking a homeland, desiring a better country, a heavenly one. And yet, what we're actually looking at is not a place, but a person. We're looking at Jesus. Let us run with perseverance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the text says. To Jesus. The text calls him a pioneer. Right? Perfecter of our faith. Pioneers blaze trails. They hack through the forest. They show you how to do it, right? This is how it works. They go before us. We look at Jesus because that's where we learn what it means to be holy. That's where we learn what it means to be truly and fully human. Really human. Really human. The Bible has this thing in it that seems to suggest that we don't know what it means to be who we are. We've lost it. We've lost it. In Romans chapter 5 and 1 Corinthians 15, the Apostle Paul talks about how Jesus didn't just come to save us. He came to show us an entirely new way of being human. He talks about Jesus as the new Adam. The first Adam in the garden with Eve and all the sin and the serpent and everything gave us life. The new Adam gives us new life. In fact, the true life, real purpose. All right? Jesus gives us our end, we could say. He shows us where we're to go and how we're to get there. And he does this in his own life. If you want to become my disciple, what are you supposed to do? Take up my cross. Follow me, right? Deny yourself. For those who want to save their life will find it, right? Those who want to save their life will find it. The passage for today was wash each other's feet. That's the idea. Jesus shows us the new way of being in the world, a new way of living. We look at how he lived, what he did, what he said. We take that as the gold standard, this die-cast mold for how we should live. Why? Because this is how we are created to live. Why do we walk the path of holiness? Why do we take the pilgrimage to the cathedral? Why do we squint at that through that windshield at those far-off mountains? Because we long to become who we were made to be. We long to become complete and true and whole. That's what perfect means, by the way. Complete. The thing about sin, though, the opposite of holiness, the thing about sin is that it's deceptive. We think we want it because we think that's what will make us happy. It'll fill us up. But it doesn't. We focus on the big me mentality, on following my dreams and my visions of success, because we think this is the way to true fulfillment. If I just did that, then I'd finally feel okay. We think this is the only way to self-realization, to becoming our true selves. But it's actually the opposite. Jesus shows us that becoming our true selves, who we are meant to be, is actually the way of the cross. It's what we're going to go through this next week. That's why it's our big Holy Week, because this is who we are. This is who we are. We give ourselves up for others, and surprise, in doing so, we find ourselves. We find ourselves. We live the life of holiness because that kind of life is what we're created to live. You see, holiness isn't just another word for authenticity. It's not just another word for not sinning. It's a word for being who we truly are. Be holy as Jesus is holy so that we can be human as Jesus is human. I once asked my brother-in-law, Mark, who works for a relief organization out west. He goes around to churches and asks them to give money. I'm terrible at that type of stuff. So I asked him, how do you do it, Mark? And he goes, Jason, I just tell them that God created them to give to other people. And this is what it means to be human. That we give of ourselves. That we give of ourselves. He says it wells up from our very DNA. This is who we are. It's what we do. We give to others because we are made to be givers. That's what I tell him, he said. So our first point is this. We look to Jesus to show us the way, the path forward, because he's the blueprint for what we want to be. We look to Jesus because he shows us how to be truly and fully human. Everything siphoned through Jesus. We also look to Jesus, however, and this is the second point. We look to Jesus because he's the goal itself. He's those towers of that cathedral. He's the mountains in the distance. He's the one we look to. He's our destination. Real joy is not the accumulation of stuff. That's John Locke's pursuit of property. All right? Real joy is not the experience of new and exciting things. That's more of Jefferson's, pursuit of happiness. All right? Real joy is communion with God, Jesus says. This is what the author of Hebrews is echoing too. Jesus was looking over the horizon, but did you catch who he was looking at? God. The right hand of God. So the definition of holiness isn't just being like Jesus, it's being with Jesus. It's experiencing this true unity, true fellowship with each other, with the world. It's what we mean when we say that lions are going to lie down with lambs. All right? It's everyone enveloped in that embrace of God. When we talk about the life of holiness, when we talk about divesting this big me mentality of ours and then investing and making right what is wrong in the world and ourselves, we have at the same time to think about communion with God, because that's what it's talking about, communion with God. If you think about holiness as just this checklist of right and wrong, you miss it. You miss it. Holiness isn't about doing right things or not doing wrong things. Holiness is about being next to God. Next to God. This is why prayer is so important, by the way. Prayer is what brings us next to God. The problem, I think, that a lot of us have is we tend to think of salvation and the goal of the moral life as getting either out of hell or getting things in the future what we don't have now, or maybe keeping them. It turns into very John Lockean property-ish type stuff. Golden roads, mountains of chocolate ice cream. That was my mom's, by the way. We laugh about this. She knows I joke about her mountains of chocolate ice cream. It's even the jewels that we think about that we can either wear or lay back down at Jesus' feet. These things are still images of a disordered understanding of who we are. They're all things we're told are going to make us happy. They're echoes of what we consume now. If I was going to dream about heaven in these terms, it'd be a whole lot of cinnamon rolls. Okay? It would. But real joy is different. It's not possessions. Real joy is people. Even the joy and the beauty of peace is not really the absence of violence. It's the presence of friends. Go off and live by yourself in the middle of an isolated island somewhere, and you will have peace. But it won't be the peace of Jesus Christ. It'll be just the absence of everything else. See, real peace isn't just the absence of violence. It's the presence of community. It's fellowship. That's the only true peace. It's the peace of Christ. It's what we shared a second ago, right? And it's not just saying the peace of Christ. It's peace with Christ. Peace we have with Christ's people. And that's exactly what God is after. This whole creation business, what Jesus comes, what he's looking for, it's community, it's fellowship, it's love of others. The story of Easter is the story of a God who would rather spend eternity in hell with sinners than eternity in heaven without them. Did you get that? Easter is a story about a God who would rather spend eternity in hell with sinners than eternity in heaven without them. That's holiness, people. That's love. This is why so many Christians have willingly been martyred for their faith. This is why the apostle can pray. He prays in Romans 11 that he'd be accursed by God. God, curse me, if that's what it takes to save my kinsmen. Curse me. Have you ever prayed that? You see, true joy comes in fellowship with God and with others. It's why we live holy lives, because this is what we see on the horizon. This is what drives us. Keeps a six-year-old awake for the last 6 hours. It's the path of holiness. So the question is, do you want it? Do you really want it? Do you remember the longing? I know some of you do. The longing to be with that person who you lost? The moment they die, all you want is them to be back. Right? Doesn't that just surpass everything else? That's what we're talking about here. That's what we're talking about. God wants it too, and he's told us how to get it. And what he said is Jesus. He said Jesus. He said follow Jesus, look to Jesus, be like Jesus, live with Jesus. Every thought, every action, everything that makes up the holy life is meant to echo this, to look forward to that. It's about being with Jesus and his people in peace. That's what we see on the horizon. My joy. That's it. That's what we're looking for. The question is, have you found it? Have you found it? I hope so. Because it's waiting for all of you.